6.5 minutes after 10 o'clock. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice is one of the best-loved works of British literature. A recent survey in England ranked it second only to The Lord of the Rings in popularity. In Australia, Pride and Prejudice ranked number one among 101 all-time best-loved books. It's been adapted for radio, television, and multiple motion pictures. It's a tale of English manners that has survived the test of time and is now labeled a classic. Well, it seems logical then that anyone would think twice or even three times about rewriting that book to fight against the living dead. But that's what has happened. A book was published on April 1st of this year titled Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. It lists two authors, Jane Austen and Seth Graham Smith, who we are waiting to get a hold of so that he can talk to us about this book this hour. Otherwise, it's going to be a pretty short program. For those who haven't yet read Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, and I would assume that includes quite a few people who are listening to this broadcast, it's a story. I mentioned it's a story about English manners. It's basically a story about a family, the Bennet family, a mother and father with five daughters. And in the 18th century, having five daughters was something of a problem because it was going to be difficult to get them married off if you weren't rich and had something to offer a potential suitor. At any rate, the main story centers around the star-crossed romance of two people involved, one Elizabeth Bennet, one of the five daughters I just mentioned, and a fellow by the name of Darcy, who is becomes her love interest, but that's kind of the story. And there's a whole lot of other subplots involved in this and all sorts of intrigues that keep the lovers apart and various other bad things that occur. The book originally published in 1813. Interestingly enough, Jane Austen sold the rights to the book before she found out how successful Sense and Sensibility had been and actually ended up losing some money on the deal. Kind of a little bit of trivia there. At any rate, this new book was just published by Quirk Press, and Quirk Classics is the imprint. And we're still looking for Seth Graham Smith, but I understand we're going to have a substitute who's going to talk about the book as soon as we can get him. So this is what is called in the radio jargon as vamping. It's a Monday morning, ladies and gentlemen. At any rate, this book combines zombies, which is sort of a modern horror genre, with the idea of, with Jane Austen's novel. And I actually did read the whole thing over the weekend, and it was a pretty interesting read. Seth Graham Smith did a great job of maintaining the original story and just adding zombies to it. And when we eventually get to talk to him, that's one of the things I want to find out about. But excuse me. Meanwhile, we have Jason Rakelak joining us. He's the editor of the book, and he's with us now by phone as we search for Seth, who is one of the two authors. And Jason, was Seth eaten by zombies, or do we know?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, you can start us out, though, by explaining exactly who thought this was a good idea to take Jane Austen's classic novel of English manners and add zombies to it.
Well, I guess that was my idea. I can tell you a little bit about how the book came to be. I had become aware of a lot of things you see on the internet where people were taking elements and sort of mashing them up. There's a DJ who took the Beatles' White Album and like Jay-Z's Black Album, and he made the Gray Album. And you'll see a lot of stuff on YouTube where people will take movie trailers and recut them in their own way to incorporate their own interests. And since I work at a book publisher, I was trying to think about how I could do that without getting sued, because as soon as you put something into print, you know, you immediately violate copyright laws and you get in trouble. So one of the first things I did was make a list of all books that were published before 1923, and those would be books that were in the public domain, so you can do whatever you want with them. So I had a list of things like War and Peace and Moby Dick, and you know, all the Dickens, all the Austen. And then I made a second list of elements you might add to enhance these novels. Pirates, robots, ninjas, monkeys. For the longest time, I thought monkeys would be really funny to put in a work of classic literature. But when I started drawing lines between these novels and the elements, as soon as I drew a line between Pride and Prejudice and zombies, it just seemed like a home run to me. And so at that point, I called Mr. Graham Smith, and I said to him, you know, I've got this great title. I want you to hear it. Just listen to it and tell me what you think. And I said, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. And he immediately knew what the whole book should be. and so that's how it basically began.
Well, I understand we now have Seth with us as well. Seth Graham Smith, are you there?
Hi, I'm here. Sorry to be late. But
that's okay.
But Jason will tell you, being late is just a way of life when you work with me. So
really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's okay. Well, you know, you're here now. That's all that counts.
Better late than never. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Seth. How are you?
I'm good. I'm looking forward, by the way, to meeting Jason in person for the first time in our almost 6-year relationship this next coming month at Comic-Con in San Diego.
Wow.
After 6 books together and 6 years of phone calls and hundreds of thousands of emails, Jason and I have actually never met.
Welcome
digital
to
age.
The new millennium.
Yes, we're digital commuters. Well, I'm a digital commuter. He actually has a real job.
Okay, well, the book itself, we just heard from Jason where he got the idea to do this. So when you first heard of it, you said, yeah, let's do this.
Well, I thought when Jason called me and said, here's the title, I honestly thought it was the most brilliant thing I'd ever heard in my life, really, you know, and I told him that. I think we talked for a long time that day about, you know, just how this book would work and how excited we both were about it, and I got as excited as Jason did immediately, and even before we knew that there would be a book, you know, it was just an idea. I went out and I got the original Pride and Prejudice and sort of read it right away to refamiliarize myself with it. You know, I hadn't really read it since I was a kid in high school. And at which point I did not really love it, you know, because as a high school boy, Elizabeth Bennet and her man troubles weren't really up on, you know, high up on the list of things that I really wanted to read about. So, you know, I sort of just trudged through it and did my book report and moved on with my life. But then when I read it, you know, just to sort of refamiliarize myself with it 18 some odd years later, it's like a light went off, and I said, well, I get it now. I understand why people love Jane Austen, because she's really funny. You know, that's just something that never occurred to me, that, you know, Jane Austen, who we all think of in these, you know, sort of Merchant Ivory costume drama movie adaptations, you know, she's really funny, and not only funny, but subversive and a little mean-spirited and snarky is a word I like to use. So, you know, once I realized, well, you know, she's also sort of satirizing these people, then it seemed like we had this, you know, permission almost from beyond the grave to go ahead and give it this treatment.
Well, it certainly seemed in the original book that this was this had to be a little bit of an exaggeration of certain aspects of the British, what I would call the British caste system that was operating at that time, and it certainly did seem like she was poking it a little bit. By really making that kind of the device that she used to tell the story, and you continued that, maintained her vision for that. I guess the thing that fascinated me was how you were able to weave in the zombie parts of the story into the story, and it was done so seamlessly. That had to have been a little bit of a challenge.
Well, that was the central challenge of writing the book. You know, I mean, the language, and you know, people, I'm sure Jason gets this this comment a lot, or this question a lot. I get this all the time when I meet people and talk about the book, and they say, you know, well, why didn't you just rewrite the whole thing from page one? You know, why didn't you just make it a wholesale, you know, adaptation instead of keeping so much of the original text and just sort of grafting or weaving, like you said, onto. And I think that was the point. That was what was so funny to us, is that, you know, the point of this exercise, the point of this mashup is not to, you know, start on page one and just rewrite someone's book. It's to you know, weave as seamlessly as possible a new story or graft a new story onto the skin of the original book as invisibly as possible, and you know, keep those themes intact, keep the characters and their motivations intact, but just, you know, I always say that we took the themes and the personalities in this book and we just turned them up to 11. You know, I mean, Elizabeth Bennet is still the fiercely independent, sharp-tongued woman who doesn't believe that she needs to be married to be legitimized. But in this version, she's a sharp-tongued woman with a sharp sword. And, you know, she, instead of, you know, verbally sparring with people about these problems, she literally spars with people about these problems. So it's all there. It's all in the original book. And like I said, all we did was kind of give it this absurd scope, this ridiculously sized bloody canvas to play itself out on.
Now, there were some people, I was reading some of the reviews of this book, there were some people who just really loved it, and there were others who said you should have put in more zombies. How did you decide how much zombie to add to this?
Well, when I started writing the book, I mean, once, you know, we went through, Jason and I worked really closely and came up with a proposal, basically, for the publisher, because there was, you know, in all fairness, and I've actually said this before to the publisher, David Borgnecht, you know, there was some reluctance to go ahead with this book at Quirk. And, you know, I think everybody thought this is a great idea, and we all think it's really funny, but, you know, the reluctance was, will it find an audience? And you know, the theory was, well, you're going to have this, you know, the zombies are going to turn off the Jane Austen fans, and the Jane Austen stuff's going to turn off the zombie fans, and you're going to be left with a book that nobody wants to read. So, you know, Jason and I worked really hard. We came up with a proposal, and finally they said, okay, well, we'll do it, but we want to get it out for, you know, I think it was the spring or something, so we need it fast. So I sat down and went through the book time and time again, you know, maybe three or four times, straight through, and made all sorts of notes in the margins and figured out, okay, well, this is what I'm going to do here, and this is what I'm going to do here. And then it was literally just a matter of opening up the manuscript on my computer, sitting down on page one, line one, word one, and starting to write new stuff over the existing manuscript in red. And so how I judged myself was, from time to time, you know, there's, you know, in Microsoft Word, you can zoom out and look at, you know, 10, 20, 30 pages at a time. I would judge the only metric I used was, am I leaving enough red in my wake? You know, it wasn't a specific word count. It wasn't, you know, well, we need this many battle scenes. We just had an idea of what the book was going to be and how it was going to flow and where the big, you know, in movies they're called set pieces, I guess, but where the big scenes were going to be, the new scenes. Sometimes I would change, you know, three or four lines on a page. Sometimes I would add two paragraphs. Sometimes there would be three or four pages in a row of new material that had never existed in the original book. The only way that we judged, the only way that I sort of, you know, and Jason would tell me too, you know, this feels a little lean here. Can you add something here? When I would turn in pages, but basically it was how much red ink had we left in our wake, and you know, if I were reading this book, would I feel satisfied? Now that said, some people aren't satisfied with the amount of zombies in the book. So you know, we took some steps to address those concerns, I guess. We have a what's it called? Deluxe heirloom edition, Jason.
That's correct. That's coming out for the holidays. With
coming
30%
out for the holidays.
More zombies.
It's a hardcover, faux leather, you know, gold stamped, the whole nine yards. Jason could probably tell you more about the production of it than I can, but it has 30% more zombies. That's our pitch. So, you know,
now with 30% more zombies.
And I actually got a chance to go back and write some new scenes and, you know, and weave in some new stuff. And so hopefully people will be satisfied with it.
Yeah, you know, if I can jump in on this one point, we've had some amazing reviews for this book. This has probably been one of the, you know, best reviewed books we've ever published. You know, Time, Entertainment Weekly, Wired, you know, all NPR. It's been in the New York Times. And you know, figuring out the formula for this, you know, there were a lot of questions. A lot of people asked a lot of different ways to approach it. There was talk about cutting parts of Pride and Prejudice, cutting entire chapters. You know, we considered doing that. We also considered at one point, people were encouraging me to highlight all the new additions in red ink so that readers would be aware of just how savvy Seth's revisions were, and, you know, and how smart and how clever they were. You know, people suggested, you know, every possible way you could approach this. But I think the ratio of like Jane Austen to zombies, I think we settled on the right formula for this book.
Yeah, I mean, it worked out to, you know, in the new edition, it's about 80-20. It's, you know, 80% of the original book is there, but there are, you know, somewhere on the order of 25,000 words of all new material.
Well, and the zombie thread runs through the whole thing, even when there aren't zombie attacks going on,
exactly,
because of the constant references to this kind of training and that kind of training and weapons and so forth that just kind of pops up and flavors the whole thing. We need to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with our two guests about this book, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Yes, it really is a book, and we really do have people here to talk about it, and you can too. What do you think? I mean, were you a big Jane Austen fan, and how would you think about this work having zombies added to it? How does that make you feel? Have you read the book? What was your response to it? It's been out since, I believe it came out April 1st, so it's been on the shelves for a little bit. Maybe you've had a chance to see it and think about it a little bit. Give us a call and let us know what you think. 800-486-8655 is the toll-free number, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. My two guests this morning, we have Seth Graham Smith, one of the two authors of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. The other one would have to be a zombie herself in order to be on with us today. And we have also the book's editor, Jason Rakolak, is also with us by phone, and you can be too, at 800-486-8655. We'll be right back to talk some more about it. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 24 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Here's what's coming up later on today on Talk of the Nation. After two on Talk of the Nation, around the world, Michael Jackson's fans have been texting, tweeting, and sharing stories. What moment sealed your fate as a Michael Jackson fan? That's after 2 o'clock today on Talk of the Nation. This hour, we're talking about the book Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, and we have one of its authors with us, Seth Graham Smith, and the book's editor, Jason Rakolak, is also with us by phone, and you can be too. We're taking calls now for our guests at 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Well, one of the things that I noticed about the book, and I alluded to this earlier, is the way that even when we don't have a zombie attack, the idea of the unmentionables is a theme that goes throughout the book. There's an interesting kind of subplot here where the aunt of one of the main male protagonists is making the point that there's one type of martial arts that's superior. You get into this whole which martial arts thing is better, Chinese or Japanese, and that it seems to me that really fit the whole rest of the book, because it was, again, it was kind of a class kind of thing. And you even ended up in with one scene, a dramatic scene where the two proponents of these two kinds of fighting actually have a duel in a dojo, and it was I laughed out loud when I read it.
Right. Well, I mean, you touched on the fact that we're basically taking the original themes and sort of writing them large. You know, in the original Pride and Prejudice, you know, there's a lot of people look down their nose within the aristocracy of, you know, if I'm richer than this person, that means that I'm more privileged than they are, and Elizabeth's family in the original book is privileged compared to most people, but compared to, you know, Mr. Darcy and Mr. Bingley and the really, really rich people, she's looked down on. Her family's looked down on as merely, you know, modestly wealthy, I guess. So the same thing is true in this book, but the way that we sort of the device we use, like you said, is the martial arts. You know, in this book, when we enter the book, the strange plague, the unmentionable menace, the zombie plague, if you will, has been the scourge of England for about 50 years, and so now the aristocracy, instead of sending their children off to, you know, the finishing schools of France to go and learn how to play the pianoforte or, you know, practice their calligraphy or whatever, They send their children off to the dojos of Kyoto and the temples of Shaolin China, and you know they go off and they get their kids schooled in the deadly arts so that they may come back to England and fight this unmentionable menace and you know, God willing, survive into old age. So that's sort of the new fashion in the aristocracy is to, you know, how trained is your child? And, you know, you know, do your daughters have their ninjas yet? And, you know, all those things. So so it's just another way that, you know, people like Darcy, who was trained in the clearly superior dojos of Kyoto, Japan, where all the really rich aristocracy go, he looks down his nose at the Bennett girls who were merely wealthy enough to afford a few trips to the Shaolin Temple, as Lady Catherine de Bourgh calls, that's the aunt you referred to, Lady Catherine,
right,
who herself is the one of the greatest slayers of zombies to ever live. She calls it those filthy Chinese peasants, as she refers to Elizabeth's masters. Now, of course, Elizabeth turns out to be the superior swordsman and musket wielder and all that, but.
Yeah, I have to. I was sitting in my house reading this, and every now and then I would just burst out laughing, and my wife was wondering what in the world's going on. So now she wants to read the book, but it was entertaining to say the least.
Well, that's good to hear, and that, you know, the reaction a lot of people have to this book, and I understand it, by the way, is sheer skepticism. You know, I mean, a lot of Jane Austen fans, I've met tons of them in the last few months, who said, you know, when I heard this title, I was prepared to hate this book. And, you know, I thought that it was going to be making fun of Jane Austen, and I thought that, you know, it was going to be disrespectful and all that. But I think that once people read the book, and once they sort of get a sense that how careful we were and how, you know, we approached this, yes, with it's silly, and yes, it's ridiculous, and yes, it makes us laugh, but we also tried really, really hard to make it good, and to make it as close to the language of Jane Austen as we possibly could, and to do it with at least a modicum of respect for the original book. So I think once people get the sense of that and they actually see that the book doesn't take itself seriously and that we're really just, you know, having fun with the themes and this doesn't deter from the greatness of the original book in any way, then, you know, I've met a lot of Jane Austen fans who have come around to love the book.
Well, I just want to read the opening line. The opening line of the book says, "It is a truth universally acknowledged that a zombie in possession of brains must be in want of more brains." Oh man, I said, okay, that's how this is going to go. I have to say that I had never read Pride and Prejudice. I escaped having to read that portion of the English classics in high school, and I didn't take English literature for 200, please, Alex, in college, and so I escaped reading it. And so this was my introduction to Jane Austen was your book. No pressure.
Yeah, right.
Jason, I want to get you in on this conversation. Sure. Again a little bit. Talk a little bit about how you felt about what have been the responses to the book generally.
Well, you know, I think the response has been largely favorable. I mean, this has been an interesting book for us as a publisher because, you know, as Seth was explaining before, you know, there was a lot of skepticism about this book. People thought it was kind of a funny idea, but we didn't have very high expectations for it. So we went out with a print run of, I think, maybe 10,000 copies, and it certainly wasn't one of the big titles that we were going to be, you know, putting a lot of marketing money behind. We were just going to sort of put it out there. And it was supposed to pub next month. Actually,
yeah, July.
It was supposed to pub in July, and around February, someone online saw a picture of the cover and a little blurb that I'd written up for the back of the book, and started blogging about it. And we noticed our Amazon sales ranking was like spiking, within I don't know maybe a week, it was on hundreds and hundreds of blogs and websites. Everybody was talking about it. In a viral manner that we have tried countless times to manufacture and we've never been able to do, you know. And everybody was intrigued. And so we immediately bumped up the pub date. We tried to figure out, you know, how quickly could we actually get books here in the United States. So we bumped the pub date up to April 1st. And there were weeks of anticipation from people who were really, really excited and really into it. And once the book started pubbing in April, you know, the good reviews started rolling in. And, you know, as Seth said, I think people have been largely favorable. There's a couple people who, you know, just refuse to acknowledge any, you know, any alteration of Jane Austen at all. You know, they don't want to see a word of the book changed. They're sacred texts, and they must never be altered.
I've seen people give the book one-star reviews on Amazon, and you go and you read the review, and the review is, you know, I hate this idea.
Right.
You know, it's not that they've read the book. It's not that they hate the book. It's, you know, they just hate the idea of the book, and you know, it's somewhat sacral. I call them the "How dare you, sir" crowd. You know, there's a very small, select group of people, much smaller, by the way, than I feared. Who just dismissed the book out of hand as some kind of sacrilege.
Yeah. I assured Seth before we published, I told him, I said, the book is review proof. If you want Pride and Prejudice with the zombies, that's exactly what we give you.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, and it's flawlessly done. And 85% of the book is, you know, one of the greatest novels of English literature.
Right, exactly. So if you hate the book, you know, you clearly have bad taste.
let's take a phone call. Peter in Stoughton wants to join us and talk about his experience with your book. Peter, good morning.
Good morning. You brought up the cover, and that's what I'm calling about. I'm a very erudite, educated guy, so I was quite aware of this book months ago. But I was in a chain bookstore with my 15-year-old daughter last week, and I rounded a corner and saw a stack of them there on the table, and while I kind of embarrassed my daughter because I was having minor convulsions there, that cover is, if the rest of the book is as good as the cover, I'm going to purchase it just as soon as I can afford it. But
I don't know if anything can be as good as the cover, you know.
Yeah, I'm holding the cover up to the microphone now so people can see it.
Well, it's such a classic take on all those books that you had to purchase in college or you were forced to read through in high school. And it's very tastefully done, and I look forward to seeing the heirloom edition that you talked about. That should really be something.
Yeah, with 30% more zombies. Don't forget
that
part.
With 30% more zombies. And, by the way, all new. You know, the illustrations in the original version, the version that's out now, are great. But the Jason and the people at the publisher went out and found an artist who has done all of these incredible, you know, almost photorealistic oil
paintings. They're oil paintings, yeah. Like
and
the
they're amazing. I mean, I've gotten to see some of them. You can see a few of them online at Quirk's website. They're going to be in the new heirloom edition, and they're really, really amazing.
What is the Quirk website?
It's quirkbooks.com.
Quirkbooks.com. That's Quirk with a Q-U-I.
Q-U-I-R-K, books.com,
yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
And
so
the cover was, by the way, the cover, I think, you know, I think Jason will agree, was the sole force, along with the title of the book, behind this viral phenomenon that, you know, that happened. I mean, nobody had actually read the book. Nobody knew what was inside the book. It was clearly just, you know, you have this cover, which is of a very, you know, it's a portrait that you might see of a Regency era woman, you know, sitting with her hands folded in her lap, and you know, sort of wryly smiling at the artist. And what a guy at Quirk named Doogie Horner did is he took that and he painted over it so that half of her face is decomposed, and you see her smiling skeleton beneath that, and there's little splatters of blood on her dress.
And her eyes are red.
And her eyes are red, exactly. And, you know, and so you have that cover, which is really striking and really grabs your attention. And then your eyes travel down and you see Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. And the whole thing is sort of designed to look like one of those Penguin classics, you know. It's really, I mean, that alone, I mean, that cover is solely responsible for selling all these books, at least in the first, you know, a couple of months before anybody knew it was inside.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the marketing of this, the unintentional marketing of this. I mean, the reason you had to move up the publication date was this thing was just getting away from you. People were demanding it. This is, and you can't buy this kind of coverage or this kind of marketing. It just has to happen. Did you learn something from this that you might be able to apply when you want to manufacture this kind of response on purpose?
I think what I learned is that nobody knows anything.
clearly nobody knows anything, and I don't think that this can be, you know, like you said, I don't know that it can be replicated. I mean, you know, you could, if you had, I guess, limitless money, and you could just saturate the marketplace with awareness of this book, but that doesn't mean that people are going to like what you're selling. You know, this is just one of those cases where, you know, we were dragged into. I mean, I can't think of when has a book ever been forced to move up its publication date by, you know, 3 months, 4 months. I'm sure it's happened, but you know, certainly not in my experience.
I can't think of the last novel that was, you know, rushed to print because of consumer demand.
Right. Exactly. You know, so it's been. Back in February, I was in upstate New York, you know, visiting family, and my phone rang out of the blue, and it was a 212 number, so, you know, New York City, and I answered it, and it was a reporter from Entertainment Weekly calling to, he wanted to get my quotes about the, quote, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies phenomenon. And I told him, well, this is the first I've ever heard that there was a phenomenon, you know? I mean, it's weird. Otherworldly experience, which is, you know, started back in February, like Jason said, when people started blogging about this, you know, and it started propagating across the internet, and it's continued up until now. I mean, I continue to be amazed. I just got back from traveling to a few different cities to do, you know, appearances to promote the book in bookstores and meet a lot of people, and you know, I was stunned in everywhere I went. The level of excitement about the book and, you know, just the number of people that wanted to come out and talk about the book and get their book signed and it's really like an out-of-body experience, you know. I mean, as Jason said, we had very reasonable expectations for this book. And the four books we'd done together before this, I mean, you know, I was excited if we broke even. I mean, honestly, you know, it wasn't really about, you know, it wasn't really about, oh, we're going to go and have a bestseller or anything. It was, our philosophy was, do we think it's funny and do we think it'll break even? You know, I mean, I think that's something that Jason writes in his online biography. You know, he's always looking for a good idea that's really funny that'll break even at least, you know. I mean, granted, we want to, you know, we always want a success and we like it when, you know, we get to make a little bit of a living off of doing this. But at the same time, you know, I would have been happy had this book just been published because I thought this is, you know, as soon as Jason called me with the idea, it was like, well, this has to exist, you know. I don't care how we do it, but this is such a good idea. It has to exist.
We need to take a break so that we can continue to exist, and then we'll be back and talk some more about Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. I have two guests on the phone with me. One of the two authors of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, Seth Graham Smith, is with us by phone, and so is the book's editor, Jason Rakolak. And when we come back, we'll have more questions. And if you'd like to join in, what do you think about the idea of taking this classic of British literature and adding zombies to it? Have you read the book? Have you seen the book? Were you one of the people who saw this online and said, this is a great idea? Let us know. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number that works just about everywhere, although I am informed it doesn't work in Australia. You can send us an email if you're from the land down under. The address is talk@wpr.org. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network. It's 10:42. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up next hour on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller is in after 11, and you'll get advice on achieving your personal fitness level. Larry's guest is Madison's personal trainer, Dustin Marr, creator of Fun Fit Boot Camps. That's coming up next hour here on the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking about Pride and Prejudice and zombies, and we have two guests. One of them is one of the authors of the book, Seth Graham Smith, and the other is the editor of the book, Jason Rakolak. And we have some callers who are going to be joining us in just a moment. Before they do, I wanted to ask what formats this book has already been published in. Is it, for example, is it available on Amazon Kindle, and is it available as an audiobook yet?
Jason? I believe it is available on Kindle, and there is an audiobook too. It's available through
Audible.com.
Audible.com. That's correct.
And who did the reading?
I actually don't know her name, Jason. You might, but
my understanding, and I may be wrong about this, but I think Audible has they have a pool of people that they use, and they use their Jane Austen person.
Yeah,
she sounds like she's the lady they have to read. Regular Pride and Prejudice.
I mean, it's incredible. She's this really charismatic British woman, and she does an amazing job of reading it.
Okay. Let's take a call from Dan in Turtle Lake. Dan, good morning.
Yes, sir. I understand you to be suggesting that it's a parody of the British class system, that you utilized what Jane Austen had done, but with... less subtlety and less, vicious or obviously vicious sarcasm.
That's correct. What we've done here is we've stripped away all semblance of subtlety.
I got that picture. Now, what kind of a reaction has there been in England to this this sort of thing?
Well, it's been mixed, just like it has, among a lot of the Jane Austen diehard fans, but mixed, mostly positive, and that's the thing that's been amazing about it is, there.
Well, I guess in part I do. I understand that. But I think of things that, I had never, I've been waiting to hear some leader talk about the fact that, the 1953 overthrow of the democratic movement in Iran, was never so identified. We were provoked and, solicited by the British to be involved in that thing, and they thought they had, right to 70-80% of the oil profitability.
Yeah, but how does this connect to Pride and Prejudice and zombies?
Well, an attitude of the English, that they got us involved in, in overthrowing a democratic, it's very indirect, but it's an arrogance. And you think of now there's a big hullabaloo in England, having to do with, the Parthenon and the return of all the artifacts that were taken, they are rather holding rather firm with respect to this was appropriate, and some of it gets a little silly, but it was interesting. I mean, there is some balance. I've heard. Well, I'm talking too much. I wanted to hear. I thought that this was very, very funny, and I'm anxious to read it.
One thing that's ridiculous to me about the, there's something very English to me about the fact that there's been zombies in their country for 50 years, and it hasn't occurred to them to leave. That sort of stiff upper lip, cheerio, carry on with life attitude is just very funny to me and very British. And, there's just this nobility about it that, even though we could go to France or Portugal or Germany and live a zombie-free existence, this is England and this is our island and we're not going to leave. And so, the English just accept this as a way of life and decide to change everything else about their life, rather than leave their beloved England. So I think that's kind of a funny comment on an English attitude in the book.
Okay, so in the universe you've created, because I didn't necessarily pick this up from the book, that the zombies are only in England. This is strictly a British phenomenon.
This is strictly a British phenomenon, right? I mean, they could just cross the channel and live a zombie-free life, but they would never even think of abandoning His Majesty's beloved jewel.
There will always be an England.
Always. There will always be England, exactly. Even if we have to go to Japan and China to train our children to fight for it.
There we go. Let's talk to Robert in Stevens Point next. Robert, good morning.
Hello. I recently read an article which has some relevance to this book. It talked about how class warfare issues, like class warfare issues are very much a part of zombie and vampire films, depending on what politicians happen to be in the White House. The argument being that, and I'm quoting from the San Diego Union-Tribune article, Democrats who want to redistribute wealth to Main Street fear the Wall Street vampires who bleed the nation dry. Republican, and then that's that. The argument there is that vampire films see a spike when Democrats are in the White House. And the other argument, Republicans fear a revolt of the poor and disenfranchised, dressed in rags, and coming to the White House to eat their brains. And that's meant to explain the spike in zombie films that occur when Republicans are in the White House.
Well, I think there's some truth to that. I think that, if you look at the history of zombies, zombies are, by the way, a 20th century phenomenon. There's really no mention of the word zombie before 1920, and they don't really become popular in mainstream culture until the middle of the 20th century when people like George Romero started making, movies like Night of the Living Dead. And but as long as they've existed, zombies have always sort of been this big, easy, target for metaphor, to represent something. They're an easy metaphor. They're a big walking metaphor for, whatever ills we find ourselves up against, whatever dangerous group mentality is out there at the time, whether it is the spread of communism or, whether it's the craft, selfish consumerism of the 1970s. Zombies have always been used to represent something, in this book, I really don't intend for them to be representing anything other than, brain-eating funny things that get killed. But, I'm sure that people smarter than I could draw some kind of conclusion from how they've been used in the book. But, that's the larger point is, I think there's some truth to that. I don't know necessarily if it relates to, Democrats, Republicans, but certainly zombies, in particular have always been used to represent something political or social.
Traditionally, vampires have been some form of royalty, counts or dukes, that kind of thing. The upper class, they're
right.
Portrayed. They have their own castle and whatnot.
Right, you're right. I mean, and vampires, unlike zombies who, by and large can't really talk and have nothing interesting to say, even if they can, beyond like a moan or something, vampires have traditionally also been very suave and very well spoken, and I think that has something to do with the fact that they're, hundreds and hundreds of years old and immortal, and as we know from recent movies, teenage and pale and very sexy. So,
there was a character in your book, Charlotte, who gets infected with the zombie virus.
Poor Charlotte, I know.
Yeah, talk a little bit about her.
Well, I think we knew that from. I knew from the get go that we needed to transform somebody. I think we needed to see one of the major characters, get infected, because it would just be too much fun to, watch them sort of fall apart. And it was a way for us to sort of get a close-up look at what the zombie plague really was. And, Charlotte seemed like the easy target, because in the original book, Charlotte is Elizabeth, our hero's sort of older, spinstery friend who, God forbid, is almost 28 and doesn't have a husband. And, and she's very sort of plain-looking and, Elizabeth and her family even sort of comment in the original book about how she's plain and how, So in this book, she's just constantly made fun of and picked on. And, it's really awful what happens to her. But she gets infected and she ends up, getting married to a sort of obese, dim-witted priest named Mr. Collins. And Mr. Collins is so dim-witted that as she becomes a zombie throughout the course of their first months of marriage, he doesn't notice. He just sort of goes on with his life, and she's sitting there mumbling, and food's falling out of her mouth, and zits are popping on her skin. It's just awful. And nobody notices except for Elizabeth what's happening to her friend, and ultimately, ultimately, she succumbs and she has to be beheaded. But when people ask me, why did you do that to Charlotte? Why did you choose to kill her? I think personally, we did her a favor, because it was either that or spend the rest of her life married to this, you know, to this dolt. So I think we let her off easy in this book.
Yeah, and her parents got to see her married. You know, that was
her parents
that was
got to see her married, which is all they cared about, exactly. And that goes back to one of the big themes of the original book, and the one that's in this book, which is, you know, some people for some mothers and some women, you know, nothing is as important as getting married. You know, everything else can be sacrificed as long as you have a husband. Nothing else matters.
To talk about Elizabeth's parents, who the way they're portrayed in the book, her mother is just a twit, and
yep.
her father is pretty much has pretty much walked away from the family and basically only contributes sarcastic remarks.
Well,
how close are they to Jane Austen's vision of those two people?
They're very close. I mean, they're practically the same. You know. Except that Mr. Bennet really only cares about seeing his daughters survive into old age, and Mrs. Bennet only cares about getting husbands for the five of them. And, you know, Mr. Bennet has nothing but contempt for his wife, who, as you said, is just a twit, and, you know, and who goes into these hysterical fits and is, you know, very melodramatic and, you know, very childish and selfish and... And so, you know, Mr. Bennet sort of, I think like a lot of, I've seen this dynamic play out in real life, by the way, a lot. You know, like a lot of fathers who've been married to their wives for decades, I guess, he sort of holds himself up in his den and reads his books and, you know, gives one-word grunt answers and sort of, you know, keeps his head down, doesn't want to cause any trouble. You know, so, I mean, again, it's just taking those original characters and slightly exaggerating them. You know, now instead of the usual histrionics of Mrs. Bennet, you know, she has these vomiting fits.
Yeah.
You know, some people might call childish, and I would agree with them.
When as soon as I saw this book and started reading it, I said, "This has got motion picture written all over it." Is there a plan to make a movie here?
There is. Now, the interesting thing about this is that, you know, for a couple of months now, we've been talking to, you know, there was a lot of interest in the book as a movie, and someone successfully has acquired the rights, and we're very, very excited about this person or this, you know, these people that are now working on the movie, but they wish to remain anonymous for a little while longer while they sort of prepare to make their announcement about the movie. So, while we can't give you any specifics, you know, I can say that it's very exciting. It's, you know, it's very top-notch Hollywood people working on this. And, you know, and if all goes well, then maybe, who knows, 2-3 years from now, we'll all be seeing Elizabeth cut off zombie heads in the multiplex.
Well, you know, I'm just thinking, I mean, the potential for the special effects crews on this thing it could just really be spectacular.
Oh, man. I mean, I can't imagine... you know, I mean, just how much fun it would be to watch this movie. I mean, it's got everything.
Yeah, there's a love story and violent swordplay, martial arts, ninjas. Gosh, I mean, you know, it's got everything. So the book is available now. It came out in paperback. You have an heirloom edition coming out when in December, before Christmas, at any rate.
That's right. Yeah, I think it should be out in November.
And it's available as an audiobook from audible.com, and it's on you think it's on Amazon Kindle?
It is on Amazon. Yeah, it's now available for Kindle, and I don't know. There'll be all sorts of things available in the next, you know, few months, and but give it a shot.
Well, what was the Seth? I'll ask you. This will be the last question. What surprised you the most after you completed this book and you went back and you reread it, you looked at it. What surprised you the most about the result?
Well, I mean, you know, just how much sense it seems to make. I think that's the most surprising thing. Is, you know, I meet people who, you know, like you, never read the original, and read this version first, and then say, "Well, I can't imagine this book without zombies." You know, I mean, it's weird, right? But you know, I have a friend who just read the book and said, "Wait, so in the original version, it's just a love story?" You know, like he couldn't imagine reading that book. Now, that's not, you know, what I'm saying. I mean, obviously, I think people should read both, but just how much sense it kind of makes, just because the themes and the characters and some of the specific plot points in the original book were so ripe for this treatment. I think that's why, ultimately, that's why it works, and that's why, you know, you're going to see a lot of these, you know, we call them mashups, come out in the next couple of years because of the success of this book. And I think that some of them will be very good, but a lot of them won't work, and it's because, you know, you can't just arbitrarily give this treatment to any book. You have to find the right ingredients. You have to start with the right book, with the right themes, the right characters, the right amount of awareness in the culture, and then you have to add the right ingredient. I think that Jason just, you know, nailed it on the first try. So,
well, congratulations. We're out of time, so we have to leave it here. But the book is Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. It's available in bookstores and on Amazon, Kindle, and everywhere else. Quirkbooks.com is where you can find some illustrations from the heirloom version that's coming out. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. Jalima Noel handled on-air production. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.